Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
You're tuned into another episode of Real College Podcast, Quarantine Edition, and I'm your host, Casey McCabe. Welcome to the Raising Awareness episode of Real College Podcast. This time around, we'll be focusing on a variety of topics that we here at Radio K feel deserve more attention. During the pandemic and the last year, we have all been overwhelmed with so much information that it's easy to overlook some critical subjects that are very near and dear to our hearts. In this extra special episode of Real College Podcast, we take a trip inside Minneapolis public schools to see how the pandemic has affected education inequalities, have conversations with domestic violence professionals, take a look at how eating disorders affect our society as well as our friends and family here in Minnesota, a dive into diabetes and the food culture in the Midwest, increasing musical diversity here at the U, and an extra special installment of Radio K Sports. You won't want to miss this. Be sure to stick around. Growing up, everyone's education experience is very different. In the first segment of the episode, reporter Isaac Maruyama takes a look at how the COVID-19 pandemic has exposed and worsened existing education inequalities. Here is Isaac with more.
Let's talk about school. More specifically, let's talk about public schools. Love them or hate them, it's impossible to deny that they occupy a unique and a very important place in our nation. This past year has seen parents, teachers, and administrators scrambling to keep schools afloat during a global pandemic. But distance learning and digital isolation are far from the only problems facing schools. There's another problem that we should be talking more about, one with a name as ugly as the reality it describes: segregation. But wait a second, isn't school segregation over? Didn't Brown v. Board settle the issue that separate but equal schools could never truly be equal once and for all? Well, all it takes is a look in our own backyard to see that school segregation never really went away.
All families hope for a school experience where their children are learning alongside their peers, where they feel safe and secure, and where they are well prepared for their futures. In some parts of Minneapolis public schools, that's happening. For the majority of our students of color and students living in low-income neighborhoods, that is not their experience.
Take, for example, Minneapolis Public Schools, one of the largest school districts in Minnesota, serving over 30,000 students in around 100 schools. The school board recently approved a plan to radically reshape the district and desegregate schools. And by recently, I don't mean in the past couple of decades. I mean less than a year ago. That clip you just heard, with the voiceover and dramatic background music, is a promotional video released by the district explaining that plan. It's called the Comprehensive District Design, or CDD for short.
The CDD examines and makes recommendations on how MPS educates students, how the school system works to meet the needs of underserved populations, and how we ensure that resources are available to meet our goals.
Okay. So clearly, the CDD is being marketed as this high-minded solution to inequity in the school district. But what's actually supposed to change? The answer is, quite a lot. Right now in Minneapolis, there's a clear division between the quality of education on the north and south sides of the city. The affluent south side has a disproportionate amount of the city's magnet schools, while the north side has a disproportionate amount of the city's students of color. The district currently has 20 racially isolated schools, meaning that 86% or more of their students are students of color. The CDD seeks to decrease that number to only 8 schools by redrawing attendance boundaries and having thousands of students change schools. At this point in the story, I found myself wondering why the district hadn't done something like this earlier. These problems have been around for a long time, but the CDD was approved in May of 2020. I did some digging and found that the CDD was far from the first time the district had tried to reduce racial inequality. As early as in the 1970s, Minnesota's State Board of Education adopted desegregation rules that required each district to report the racial composition of its schools. And if the minority population of a school was 15% larger than that of the district, they were required to, and I quote, make a comprehensive plan for the elimination of such segregation. But at some point, that changed. In the late 1990s, the state started to heavily adopt a model of school choice, allowing parents to choose where to send their kids to school, and loosening their stringent desegregation requirements. The St. Paul Pioneer Press described the new rules as, quote, ending mandatory integration in Minnesota. This shift in policy had real effects on the state. In 1995, the Minnesota chapter of the NAACP sued the state of Minnesota for its failure to desegregate schools. The lawsuit resulted in a program called The Choice Is Yours, which used state money to bus low-income Minneapolis students to better-off suburban schools. But it didn't address the glaring inequalities that continue to exist within the city's schools. And in 2015, the lead counsel of that 1995 case sued the state again for the exact same reasons.
Structural and policy level factors exist within Minneapolis public schools that deprive students of the educational experience they need and deserve. And vast differences in outcomes and experiences for students exist by race, geography, and housing status.
That brings us back to the present and back to the CDD. So what does all of this tell us? Does the long and messy history of Minnesota's battle with school segregation mean that the CDD is doomed to fail, like so many similar proposals that came before it? I'm not that cynical yet, but if I've learned anything from researching this story, it's that desegregation efforts are only successful when the pressure is on, or when it's financially expedient for the schools to make a change. The effects of the CDD won't be seen for another year or so, due to the pandemic and the massive changes that it requires. But when it does get put in place, pay attention. High-minded rhetoric and appeals to equality are one thing, but actual results for students and families are another. From Real College Podcast at Radio K, this is Isaac Maruyama.
In the next segment, you will hear from myself and producer Emma Morris. We teamed up to find out how the pandemic has affected domestic violence and help spread the word about resources available to victim survivors. Take it away, Emma.
Recently, Casey and I sat down with Becky Smith, the communications director of Violence Free Minnesota, to discuss COVID-19 and its impact on domestic violence in Minnesota. Here's what we discussed. Could you give our listeners a little background on what Violence Free Minnesota is?
Violence Free Minnesota is a statewide coalition of programs working to end relationship abuse. We've existed for over 40 years, and our programs serve over 55,000 survivors across the state every year.
When was Violence Free Minnesota created?
Violence Free Minnesota was originally founded as the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women in 1978. And the coalition formed right after the start of one of the nation's very first shelters for survivors of domestic violence in St. Paul, Women's Advocates. Women's Advocates is still around today, serving victim survivors and their children. And the coalition was formed because after the development of the first shelter and then other shelters and services that happened around the state. So when Women's Advocates was created in the 70s, and then other services and programs started being developed to support victim survivors and their children, people who were forming these organizations realized that what needed to happen was policy change, and policy change on a statewide and governmental level. And so recognizing that there would probably need to be another organization or entity going into the legislature to ask for funding or to ask for changes to the law, they realized that developing a separate organization to represent these programs and these shelters would be a great idea and would be a way that they could sustainably put pressure on the government to create more responsive programs for victim survivors and their children. So the coalition was then made you know, really born out of that second wave feminist movement of the 70s.
What are some of the major victories Violence-Free Minnesota has had, and what are some things that you are still battling?
One of the reasons why the coalition exists is to ensure that programs are sustainable. And so often this means gaining funding for programs, for shelters that are providing essential public safety services. So right now we are in a funding year at the Capitol, and ensuring that programs have a sustainable funding stream is one of our top priorities. We're also very much invested in figuring out affordable housing solutions for victim survivors and their children, as well as everyone. We know that economic justice is cornerstone to creating safety. Homelessness is one of the fallouts from experiencing domestic violence. And then also domestic violence is a leading cause of homelessness for women specifically. And so we know that when we are going to the Capitol and advocating for affordable housing, for reducing barriers to safe and affordable housing, we are therefore increasing the safety for victim survivors and their children.
How has the quarantine and the pandemic as a whole affected rates of domestic violence in Minnesota?
We know in typical years, we know that over 55,000 Minnesotans will reach out to domestic violence programs. And we know that that's only a third of people who experience abuse in our state every year. So since the pandemic, what we have seen as far as domestic violence advocacy programs, right after the stay-at-home order last March, we saw an initial spike, about 26% increase in calls to domestic violence programs across the state. That then dropped off, that increase dropped. And then in late summer and into fall, we saw that number steadily increasing again. So what we can say from that, what we can assume, is that as the pandemic, that initial stay-at-home order happened, and then as the pandemic once again became worse in terms of numbers there towards late summer and into fall, what we can say is that people were starting to experience extreme isolation, and that safety net services that would typically be there for them were taken away. And when I say safety net services, I'm not simply talking about kind of formalized services, but those safety net services that we don't even consider as safety net services, such as groups of friends, such as connections to your family, connections to your neighborhood. Perhaps that could also be a library. We can also say that as calls have been increased, and as calls do come into the hotlines that exist across the state, that what victim survivors are reporting is an increase in the severity of abuse. So then one other thing around the pandemic and isolation is that isolation is a tactic of abuse. So oftentimes when someone is being abusive, they will isolate the person who's being victimized.
How has the pandemic affected Violence-Free Minnesota and other services' abilities to help victim survivors?
Sure. So at the beginning of the pandemic, we were most concerned about victim survivors understanding that our programs were still open. Our programs remained open throughout the stay-at-home order, and we were very concerned that people would think that domestic violence programs were not available or were in some way shut down. And they were not, they did remain open. Shelters specifically had to, you know, very rapidly change the way they offered services, because oftentimes shelters are set up in kind of like shared housing situations, right? So it can resemble kind of a dorm style of housing, because shelters are typically temporary. Right, they're very brief, temporary stays until a victim survivor and an advocate can work together to find out more permanent housing for that person and perhaps their children. So during the beginning of the stay-at-home order, shelters and programs worked with hotels across the state to try to manage housing in that way for victim survivors. And then some shelters also were able to very quickly kind of erect separate rooms in their shelters. And they were really guided by the Minnesota Department of Health in maintaining very safe COVID protocols. And so those things continue today. So there are still hotel relationships. There's hotel setups for victim survivors, and they're able to stay in a hotel, but then they're also still able to access that advocacy, those advocacy services that can help navigate, you know, the complexities of finding new housing or finding a job and things like that.
How can those in need of domestic violence advocacy services find them?
So domestic violence advocacy services exist for all 87 counties in the state of Minnesota. So domestic violence advocacy services are available in all of the counties across Minnesota. One central helpline that exists is the Minnesota Day One helpline. And that number is 1-866-223-1111. And that's a phone number. There's also a text number, because we know that sometimes it can be really hard to make a phone call when you're living or you're in close proximity to the person who is harming you. So the text line is 612-399-9995. And the Minnesota Day One hotline phone and text numbers are available. And it's a centralized location where someone can call, connect with an advocate, and then that advocate can help kind of guide that person as to their next steps, and then also put them in touch with the domestic violence program that's in their town or city.
Is there anything else that we missed that you would like to add for our listeners?
Domestic violence advocacy programs are available to victim survivors, as well as people who have those in their life that they might believe are being harmed. So if you have someone in your life who you think might be experiencing abuse or harm, you can reach out to the Day One hotline, or you can reach out to the Domestic Violence Advocacy Program in your area and say, I have someone I'm really concerned about. I'm really concerned about how to navigate this situation. What do you suggest I do? And then an advocate can also talk to you about helping your friend or family member develop a safety plan. You can become a resource yourself for your friends and family members. And that's really important. So understanding what resources are available in your area is a way that you can really advocate and really take on the role of being supportive to people in your life. I also want to say that if someone in your life comes to you and says that they're being harmed in their relationship, the most important thing you can do is to listen to them and to believe them. So often, victim survivors feel a sense of shame or feel that they can't talk to people about what's happening to them. And they are also so oftentimes feeling very isolated in their experience. So when someone tells you that they're being harmed in their relationship, say, thank you so much for telling me about this, and then listen to them, believe them, and then ask them, you know, how it would be best to support them. Do they want resources? Do they just need to know that they can text you and you will respond to them? You know, really ask them what they need, and then prepare yourself to be that person that they need. And that might mean, again, providing domestic violence advocacy resources, helping navigate a safe place to go, things like that.
To get a better understanding of how the COVID-19 pandemic has impacted rates of domestic violence, we spoke with Dr. Ruby Nguyen, a professor in epidemiology at the University of Minnesota's School of Public Health. Dr. Nguyen says that a variety of factors have impacted domestic violence rates.
So let me introduce another term, gender-based violence. And the reason I think it's important here to think about gender-based violence is the impact that we're seeing across the board that relates to women during the COVID epidemic. But I think the economic impact of, for example, women leaving the workforce during the pandemic is particularly important now. We see the economic impacts now that more women are leaving the workforce than men. So that's clearly a gender-related issue. Why may women be leaving the workforce more than men? Because women still generally have more family and child caretaking responsibilities than men do. So when our children are home, out of school, when our parents need extra help, it's generally the women who are taking care of these things. And it's hard to manage work and these types of family responsibilities. Also, women tend to be in these hourly positions or are more likely to be laid off. Simply, they're more likely to be laid off because they're in more entry-level positions than are men. So in these situations in which businesses have had to lay off individuals, it is more often than not that women are being laid off. Now, you might wonder, well, why is she talking about labor during this conversation about domestic violence? And it's because a lot of these economic and social factors also influence not only the perpetration of violence, but also how it becomes a gender-related issue.
What were you looking to find in your study?
So what we did was we asked the question simply, is there evidence, is there data out there that suggests there was an increase in gender-based violence in Minnesota during the early part of the pandemic? The concern was that pandemics, we know, and we've seen this, for example, with cholera outbreaks or when there's other instabilities aside from health-related conditions such as war or famine, when there's a high level of community stress, violence goes up. When there is an economic downturn, violence goes up. When there are issues that are particularly related to gender, so as I described, less women in the workforce or greater economic instability for women, violence goes up.
How did the stay-at-home order affect those who were specifically staying at home with their abuser?
So one of the concerns was that the message of safety is that everyone is going to be safer in their homes. And the fact is, we know that is not the case. And whether it's perpetration of violence from a husband to a wife, or perpetration of violence of sexual abuse from a parent to a child, or elder abuse, we know for a fact that, unfortunately, home is not always the safest place. Now, in the legalese of the statute in Minnesota, it had always stated that if you feel unsafe in your home, you may leave your home. It also says, in the case of an emergency, call 911. So to some degree, this was considered. One of the issues that resulted, though, is that it wasn't clearly communicated. One of the first things that the Minnesota Department of Health did was they came out with a flyer and listed all the things or places that were open during that stay-at-home period. And unfortunately, they did not list, for example, shelters for domestic violence or hotlines for domestic violence. So there was some confusion in the beginning whether or not these agencies whose aim is to help people in this situation, if they were open or not. So that's a really important point, and it did actually contribute to some of the results that we have.
How did you go about gathering the data you used in your study?
We looked at individual municipalities, and those are cities and counties in the Twin Cities area, to determine if during this 9-week period of the stay-at-home order, were there more domestic violence calls than there were in the previous year. So let's say 2019 is our background rate, and 2020 is our epidemic rate. And again, we're talking mid-March to mid-May, we did see an increase in 911 calls related to domestic violence in virtually every municipality that we looked at. And what we observed in the St. Paul data was that overall there was a 32% increase in domestic violence calls from year to year. In Minneapolis, there was also an increase over the same period of time. It was a less dramatic increase. It was 10.8% increase. And what we know now also is that in general, there were more 911 calls, right? So whether that be thefts, burglaries, maybe vandalism, sure, there were an increase in number of calls. So we might think, well, maybe the domestic violence calls increased simply because there are more 911 calls overall. Well, the problem with that logic logic is that when we looked at the pie, so if we think about all 911 calls to St. Paul as a big pie, we saw an increased percentage of that pie due to domestic violence in 2020 versus 2019.
What other factors played into your research and your findings in the end?
The other thing that we looked at was data from a survey that was sent out by my community partner, Violence Free Minnesota. And they asked questions regarding the pandemic itself. And so one of the things that they saw was that there was actually a self-reported decrease in the numbers of contacts to these agencies during this period of time. And that was very curious. It was unclear why women were less likely to contact these agencies during this period. How can we explain how we saw a drastic and consistent increase in 911 calls, and yet we see fewer calls to domestic violence agencies? That was really baffling to us. So one of the things that we thought of collectively was, wait a minute, if women don't know that these agencies are open, they're not going to call them. So, and maybe they'll call 911 instead. And that was absolutely the case. So the agencies reported that women were saying that. The women were confused. So that's the potential explanation for these differences in results. That's explanation number one.
Would you like to elaborate on some other potential explanations?
A second explanation is that we have some evidence to suggest that these domestic violence incidents are actually more severe. We know with ecological data that there are more gun sales, and we know that the police departments are reporting a higher proportion of these incidents involving weapons, in which case, no matter if she knows or not that the domestic violence agency is open, she's more likely to call 911 simply because it's a more severe act. And then another possibility that we have evidence for is that these agencies, while they are there for emergency use, for example, a woman needs to get out of her house right now. Let's say she was beaten or her children were beaten. She calls 911. Now she has to go somewhere else to stay. But agencies also have other purposes. Agencies can help a woman with long-term planning, for example. So she can speak with them over a period of time, talk about what her escape plan is, talk about how to prepare financially, how to prepare the children, how to maintain health during this period of time. So she might be in regular contact with the agency. What the agencies were reporting, though, is during the lockdown period, she had no separation from her abuser. Some of the agencies were reporting that women were making phone calls from their closets. Maybe she could make a 911 call, but she couldn't make a series of phone calls to help her long-term plan an escape from this house.
Dr. Nguyen explained how increased social isolation has negatively impacted victims of domestic abuse.
This is an important topic. We don't have much data on this, but this is an important topic that I think everyone should think about, is something called collective trauma. So let's say in a non-pandemic, a woman who is in an abusive relationship wants to leave either permanently or temporarily, she might consider going to her sister's house or her best friend's house, right? But the problem during this collective trauma period is that her sister and her best friend are going through the same stressors. Now, they might not have violence in their home, but they might have economic instability. They might not have their children in school. They might be caring for their elderly and worried about COVID exposure themselves. So it made it more difficult for a woman to rely on her natural networks because she didn't have them.
We know during COVID that a lot of these programs are on the chopping block. There's decreased funding all around. So Dr. Nguyen, what is your opinion? Should we be funding this? At what level should we be funding this? Is this important work?
My opinion is that consistent funding is very important to these agencies. One, because it brings in consistent talent and employees. This is damn hard work for them. I mean, they see violence, they see the worst situations possible, and because they are community-based, essentially they see it in their sisters and their cousins. You know, not literally their sisters, but these are people who live in their community. These are families that go to the same school as their children. These are real life examples, and these are really hard for them. And so consistent funding would allow for, you know, longevity of these employees, enough resources to support these employees, because they're struggling too.
We would like to thank those at Violence Free Minnesota and the entire Minnesota Domestic Violence Awareness Network for their help with this podcast, as well as their help providing resources to the community in these trying times. If you would like to support them, feel free to look them up online or on social media. The work that they're doing is great.
For Real College Podcast, I'm Emma Morris.
And I'm Casey McCabe, signing out. In addition to domestic violence and victim survivors, another class of Minnesotans who have been severely impacted by the pandemic are those suffering from eating disorders. In this segment of the podcast, reporter Shannon Brault brings us the lowdown on how COVID has been affecting those with eating disorders, as well as what we can do as a society to help those affected. Here is Shannon with more.
Eating disorders are the most commonly linked mental illnesses to an early death. Research shows that 9% of the U.S. population will have an eating disorder in their lifetime, and that's pretty on par with about 9% of the global population having an eating disorder at some point in their lives. There are a lot of ideas out there in the world about what eating disorders are, but I can tell you what they're not. They're not a choice, they're not for attention, they're not all the same, and they do not just affect one group of people. Eating disorders are common. Chances are you know someone or multiple people who currently have or have had an eating disorder. And if you can't think of anyone, you know someone, you just don't know who it is. There are different groups and nonprofits working in eating disorder prevention and assistance in recovery, including a Twin Cities-based organization called Withal. Withal is a nonprofit working in eating disorder prevention through their What to Say initiative that changes the conversation of food and body around children. They also have their financial assistance program that helps people seek intensive treatment. I sat down with Lisa Radzak, the executive director of Withal, to talk about eating disorders, prevention, recovery, and overall what the goal of Withal's work is.
We know right now, as we're talking, there are 2 million kids alive in the United States who are healthy and well, who do not now have an eating disorder, who we know from research, these 2 million kids will have an eating disorder before they reach adulthood, if nothing is done to change their trajectory. We also know that every 52 minutes, someone dies from an eating disorder. The goal of Withal is those 2 million kids never have disordered eating or an eating disorder, that they don't even know what Withal is or that it exists. And they don't even know what they missed because we were here and did this work. The other goal of Withal, that every 52 minutes someone died, that it stops because we can treat eating disorders. We know how to treat eating disorders. We need to work together to raise awareness, to get rid of stigma and shame so that people who are struggling can feel the strength to go ahead and both realize they're struggling and get help that they need so no more people die.
Withal's What to Say initiative equips adults with simple, necessary tools to talk to kids about food and body in a way that is health-based and not diet culture-based. The words we say to others has a profound influence on them whether we know it or not. A throwaway comment for you can make all the difference for another person, especially children. So many people can tell you vivid experiences of adults telling them that they were getting, quote, fat or too heavy, and many times these experiences happen when kids are really young.
So what led me to the work is I had an eating disorder for, over a decade. I have maybe one or two memories of being involved in an activity as a kid and not thinking about my body and how it looked and feeling ashamed of it, very truly. When I was 5, I remember this, I was in kindergarten, and I remember the first time an adult said to me, you know, you need to watch your weight, you're starting to get heavy. My most vivid memories are being ashamed of how my body looked and all these incidents of sort of what adults said or did that made me feel shame and anxiety about my body.
Everyone experiences eating disorders differently. Like many things in life, they're not a one-size-fits-all type of struggle. But what is it like living with an eating disorder, and what's it like recovering?
You wake up and you're sure you're going to do today differently. And you're sure you're going to manage the food and body image thing differently. And you're going to tell yourself you feel good and you're going to eat the right way and you're not going to do it again. You're not going to spiral into this thing again. And lo and behold, you do. You fall into the same patterns and you're spiraling again. And the whole time you feel just this deep shame, this deep, deep shame that you can't figure this out. That you can't figure this simple thing about how to live in your body and how to eat out. And this goes on and on in the things we do in those days and hours that hurt ourselves, that physically hurt ourselves and that just absolutely damage our psyche. It's profound, and some of us can't even speak of these things that we've done. And this all goes on in silence. This all goes on in secrecy, right? And people that love you the most, even to this day, don't know about it. And it's happening everywhere, all the time, to really incredible people, right? And it needs to stop. The shame of, in terms of feeling like I'm not sick enough, or I should figure this out, or it's just hell and it needs to stop.
So how can you get involved?
First off, for with all, the one of the most important things we hope people will do is go to our What to Say page. It's on the withall.org site, or at a direct URL at www.whattosaynow.org. And we have a pledge to stop diet and harmful weight talk around kids. So just to sign up to take that pledge. And that's a way you're already then immediately involved in withall. So then you have information on how to contact us for other things through that. So in addition to that, you can get involved by volunteering, signing up to volunteer. There's no end to the needs that we have and the diversity of needs we have. So just about anybody who has time and talents and wants to spend their time and talents in a certain way, we can find a place. We have needs that vary throughout the year that will probably fit. We always need small or large donations. Any amount helps. Signing up to become a sustainer and join our Not One More Club for small gifts, like I said, in any amount. And then that way you can continue to receive information throughout. Other ways to get involved in eating disorder advocacy. There's a really phenomenal org called the Eating Disorders Coalition for Policy and Action. They have either once or twice a year, depending on the circumstances of the year, they have a advocacy day in Washington, D.C. And that's probably the top way to get involved in advocacy at the political level.
Another really important thing to do is to educate yourself and others about eating disorders and what they really are. You can find a lot of information on the National Eating Disorder Association website about eating disorders and other information about how to talk to people going through an eating disorder or eating disorder recovery. Recovery is possible, and a world without eating disorders is possible with the help of us all.
Just over 1 in 10 Americans has diabetes, according to the CDC. Yet many people do not know very much about this common but very dangerous disease. In this segment of the podcast, reporter Casey Salazar explains how the disease works, as well as how those suffering from it have been affected by the pandemic. Here's Casey with more.
The biggest Minnesotan cultural event takes place every year in St. Paul. It's filled with 12 days of fun, thousands of people, animals, competitions, rides, and crazy foods. Yes, I am talking about Minnesota State Fair. At the fair, you can find delicious greasy cheese curds, deep-fried Reese's peanut butter cups, or how about a bucket of Sweet Martha's chocolate chip cookies? These are all mouth-watering foods we eat at the fair, but too much can be concerning to our own health. Obesity, heart problems, depression, diabetes are some of the many risks someone can encounter with a poor lifestyle. Today, we will be focusing on diabetes.
Diabetes means too much, basically means too much sugar. Sugar in the blood and sugar in the urine.
This is the definition of diabetes according to Dr. Laura Lefebvre. She is an endocrinologist at Hennepin County Medical Center. As an endocrinologist, Dr. Lefebvre specializes in the glands and the hormones the body makes.
Our bodies have to make a hormone called insulin. And insulin is made by your pancreas. And its job is to convert that sugar into energy for the cells. The problem in type 2 diabetes is that the body is making insulin, but it doesn't recognize it well.
Imagine eating a Hershey chocolate bar. With type 2 diabetes, the body will produce insulin, but it will not respond to the insulin well. This will lead to high blood sugar levels. On the other hand, in type 1 diabetes, insulin is a whole other story.
And this is a form of diabetes where your body just stops making insulin at all. And so there's no longer any production of insulin from the pancreas. And because of that deficiency in insulin, the blood sugar has nowhere to go. And so it just rises up in the bloodstream. And the treatment for that is absolutely insulin. People who have type 1 diabetes have to take insulin, otherwise they die.
There's one last type of diabetes called gestational diabetes, which can happen when women are pregnant. It's a temporary situation, and it will only last while women are pregnant. Going back to type 2 diabetes, a big part of developing the illness can be your family history.
You know, when somebody gets diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, a lot of how things will go will depend on what they were doing with their diet and sort of lifestyle and exercise and how they're able to adjust that. There are plenty of people who develop type 2 diabetes who already have what we would say is a very healthy diet. They don't eat a lot of sweets or sugars and they still get type 2 diabetes. And that's what I'm trying to kind of say is really related to sort of your genetics or your family history, maybe more than even your lifestyle.
Besides tracking what you eat and when or how much you exercise, type 1 diabetes has many other lifestyle changes too.
The changes in the, you know, adaptations that somebody who's diagnosed with type 1 has to make very quickly, it's very abrupt. They have to start really monitoring their blood sugars very carefully. And so that might mean testing their blood sugar up to 4 or 6 times per day. They have to inject insulin for their baseline. So everybody needs insulin even when you're not eating. And then they also have to inject insulin every time they eat something that contains any carbohydrates or sugar in it.
Diabetes has no cure, but technology has helped improve the lifestyle for type 1 and type 2 diabetes. There are insulin pumps that inject insulin whenever your body needs it, and there are glucose monitors that monitor your sugar levels without having to prick your fingers. Even though with all this new technology, living with diabetes is hard and life-changing. I spoke to Liam Mitchell, the owner and founder of Pretty Simple, an online boutique based in Lakeville, Minnesota, who gives back to the diabetes community. Leah's daughter was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes when she was just 10 years old.
Yeah, that's something you'll never forget. Gracie was losing weight and then trying to get her to gain weight, and we were just having her drink high-calorie shake before lunches, and then we went on spring break, and I had made it my mission that week to try and get her to gain weight. So we were all the high-calorie snacks and treats and whatever she wanted, but I was watching her weight while we were there because her recent weight loss, and from the time that we got there to the time that we left, she had lost 7 pounds, and because I'm a pediatric nurse and I recognized the other symptoms, she was constantly thirsty. She just was going to the bathroom constantly. And so I knew before we went home, that was my suspicion, that she was type 1. I did wait till Monday morning, and I think I started dialing the doctor at 7:59 a.m. just so I could get in right away, call, and I told them what my concern was. Without an earshot of her, they did her blood sugar and had her pee in a cup and sent her straight to the hospital.
There has been significant life changes Leah and her family had to go through after the diagnosis of her daughter.
I never go to sleep without knowing where her blood sugar is at. She wears a continuous glucose monitor now. We have an app on our phones that allow us to see what her blood sugar is at any given time. We always have to have sugar either, you know, in the house, in cars, in our purses. Traveling is a challenge because you have to think of, okay, if we are going for how many days, how many vials of insulin are we going to need? How many set changes are we going to need? She wears an insulin pump. So making sure you have all the supplies. When does her sensor expire? Does she have an extra one with just in case? You have her meter, ketone stick, alcohol swab.
Leah and her husband felt helpless not being able to help their daughter cure her disease.
Pretty gut-wrenching for a parent not to be able to make it better and put a band-aid on it and say it's going to be okay, because in some ways it's not. It's always there. My husband and I just were feeling helpless not being able to do that for her, and that's where we decided that Pretty Simple would create a product that would help raise money. That's when we launched Pretty Simple Cure Mittens, and $5 per pair of mittens sold is donated, and then just an overall percentage of our sales are Pretty Simple as a whole company is also donated.
Today, Pretty Simple has donated over $25,000 to the diabetes community. I had to ask a final question. Why should people be concerned about diabetes?
I think if you ask someone, just about everyone you know knows someone who either has it or has been affected by it. I hope that Gracie lives to see the day that there is a cure.
For Real College Podcast, I'm Casey Salazar.
The University of Minnesota has taken a strong stance on diversity, but beyond admissions, diversity becomes this buzzword that can be hard to identify when you see it. In this segment, reporter Ethan Olson takes a dive into how the U is using music to achieve its goal of increasing diversity. Here's Ethan with more.
It's a librarian's job to stay on top of what is new and needed for the community. On the University of Minnesota campus, diversity is a massive part of the culture, and as a result, resources all around campus need to emulate that. Jessica Abbasio is a music librarian on campus who has been working on adding a more diverse selection of composers and other artists so that students can have access to their amazing art. So I sat down with Jessica as well as Mark Engebretson, the library's director of communications, to see how this initiative got started.
So I came to the libraries in 2018, and I was working with some students that first semester who were looking for very specific pieces by a Mexican composer named Manuel Ponce, and we just didn't have them. And when I started digging into the collection, I noticed that we did not have very many composers who were from Central or South America at all. So it just seemed like a great opportunity, especially because I knew there were students interested in this repertoire to kind of build up our collections in that area. And there are some music libraries in different places that are strong in Latin American composers or Asian American composers or different composers from different perspectives. And I just felt like this was a great opportunity for us to build our collections in that way and make it possible for students to access things that they might not otherwise have had access to.
Since the process is still in its early stages, there's still a lot of room to grow for the library.
So we started with that Central and South American repertoire just because there was somebody that asked for it, but we really would like to expand this into a broader kind of initiative. I've started talking with students and faculty and people in my own personal network of musicians about their interests in music by Asian American and East Asian composers. It's not the kind of thing where you can just buy a bunch of stuff and then you're done. Like, I think it's important to continue this work throughout the year and then as the years progress to make sure that we're always staying on top of new publications when they come out.
As well as the library has been doing with adding more diversity among its artists, the work doesn't just stop here.
My personal kind of goals for this is to continue our work with Latin American composers, Central and South American composers, and then expand next into East Asian and Asian American, and then continue. I mean, there's lots of other different musical traditions that we could explore, which I'm really excited about, like Middle Eastern composers, composers, obviously African-American and Black composers, Caribbean composers is another area that I think would be so wonderful to build collections just because these materials aren't necessarily always easily accessible to people. So as a library, if we can buy this stuff and lend it not just to music students, but to anybody.
But this new music isn't simply for students. The entire Minneapolis and Twin Cities communities have the same access.
When the space is open, anybody can come in. You don't have to have like a swipe card or anything. Anybody could just park and walk right in or take the light rail and come right in the door and visit us. But right now, yes, the best way for people who are not students or faculty or staff at the university to get access to our collections is to go to their local public library and ask the librarians there to help them with an interlibrary loan request. And those folks will be really glad to kind of walk through the process and help with finding things in our collections and then placing the request to have them sent to that public library branch for pickup.
Thankfully, there's already a system in place for community members that want to access this great music.
Where they can use interlibrary loan is we have a division called Minitex, which actually serves almost every library, public and private, in the state of Minnesota, and many in the Dakotas as well. And they've got minlink.org, mnlink.org, where you can search there for what you want, and you can go through the whole process of interlibrary loan right there. And if it's a book or something that the University of Minnesota has, then you'll be able to access it that way.
Even while being affected by the COVID-19 pandemic, the libraries that have remained open can distribute any music required. Libraries that remain open on campus are Wilson, Walter, McGraw, and the Health Sciences Library, and any of these locations can hold scores or articles for students that request them.
Last year, started lending our CDs and DVDs out, and so many have gone out through interlibrary loan, which makes me so happy every time I see these boxes of things going out, because we have so many great collections and we want people to use them. We can only mail things to addresses in the US right now, but we can mail things to your house because we know not everybody can make it to campus. Absolutely everything that we have in our library's collection, if it's at a library location that's not currently open to the public, we can get it to anybody who needs it.
Public outreach, whether it be through classes or social media, has been a massive part of this initiative. So students, be on the lookout to see how music is utilized in your own classes.
I know of one in the sociology department that looks at the development of music and language. And one of my colleagues, who's our liaison for sociology, Kat Nelson, and I did a couple of sessions with that class and worked with the faculty member to try to incorporate both music materials and then sociology-specific reference materials, those kinds of things.
So we do a lot of communications, and if you're talking about campus specifically, we do email campaigns for faculty, instructors, researchers, and students, graduate students and undergrads. And so we always include, you know, the highlights, you know, what we think our audience needs to know. We've been promoting the Racial Equity Collections Fund that is relatively new. We had an actual fundraising Give to the Max Day. That was our focus, to try to diversify our collections. And I think we had well over 30 donors for that, which we were pleased with. We don't want to be static, right? We want our collections to grow, and not just grow in size, but to grow in diversity and reflect the real world.
Even though the initiative is focused on a diverse selection of artists as a whole, attention has not been taken off of local artists, as these are the ones that represent our diverse community.
I think it's really important that our library puts, you know, time, effort, resources into collecting materials from local artists, because other libraries outside this region might not feel that that's as much of a priority. And for us to be able to collect those things, whether it's CDs or scores or books or whatever it is that the local like artists in the community are creating, like, I really think that is a great way to share those materials with a broader range of users. So we always try to buy Doomtree CDs, like when albums, when they're released, and buy scores by local composers. That is definitely something that we think is very important at the music library, and that we've definitely made as much effort as we can to kind of get to know the local scene. I'm not from Minnesota, I'm actually from New York City. So like, I'm new to the area, so I'm still learning who's, you know, releasing albums and who's publishing scores. That's something that's really important to us and really exciting to be able to say, hey, we have this local stuff that no one else has, come borrow it from us.
The idea around creating a more diverse selection of music seems to revolve around making the music library, as well as all libraries, a welcoming place for all. To make the library a creative space for everyone that steps foot on campus and that has an interest in music. And with the process already in place, the campus seems to be on the right track.
I think it's that the libraries are a place that you can come to discover new things. And it's really expensive to buy things when you're a student, right? So if libraries can make things available to you that you didn't even know you needed, it can be an opportunity to help you kind of spark new ideas and explore new concepts that you maybe hadn't thought of otherwise. So I feel like this collection development work is really important, because we're providing those resources for the students, especially for the students, but for faculty, for community researchers, for everybody to kind of discover new things that they wouldn't have otherwise had access to. The libraries isn't just for music students, the art and architecture library isn't just for art students. These materials are for everybody. So we want to make sure we're supporting all of those different types of classes.
I would like to give a huge thank you to both Jessica and Mark for their time, and I wish them the very best in the next steps of diversifying the music library on campus. As for me, this is Ethan Olson of Radio K, signing out.
Before this extra special episode of Real College Podcast draws to a close, we will hear from Jason Ruttman from the Radio K Sports Hour. In this extra special installment of Sports Hour, Jason highlights a Big Ten sport where the Gophers may dominate, but fans may not always be watching. Take it away, Jason.
Hi everyone, I'm Jason Ruttman with Radio K, Real College Radio. For this segment, I wanted to discuss Gopher men's baseball. Their season will begin in less than 2 weeks, and hopes are high for their squad. Led by slugging third baseman Jack Wassel and versatile infielder Zach Robbie, the Gophers have, in my opinion, a very good chance to win out in the Big Ten, just as they did in 2018. I had the amazing opportunity to speak with Jack Wassel, who was named D1 Baseball's Big Ten Breakout Player of 2020, and breakout hitter of 2020. Here's what he had to say. Jack, thanks so much for joining me today. Let me ask you, you're an Illinois guy. How'd you get into baseball, and what led you up here to the University of Minnesota?
Well, I got into baseball at an early age. I played a lot of sports just growing up as a kid. Soccer, football, baseball, and basketball were kind of the things growing up. My dad, obviously, I think, introduced it to me. That's usually the story for most guys. And kept playing and playing, and it kind of dwindled down to football and baseball in high school. And I started getting some notices in high school from some colleges, and some Big Ten schools and started reaching out to them and, you know, going to prospect camps and whatnot. And I think it was towards the end of my junior year, beginning of my senior year. I never had really thought about going to Minnesota, but my dad came up to me one day and said, hey, we're going to go to a prospect camp at Minnesota. And I was like, okay. And we went and I ended up playing well there and they invited me back and I ended up there, but I had never thought of Minnesota as a destination for me. I always wanted to go to Indiana, Purdue or Michigan State or something like that. But I'm glad it worked out that way because I'm more than happy here at Minnesota.
Yes, we're happy that you're here too. Let me ask you, can you walk me through a day in your life as a University of Minnesota baseball player?
Yeah, sure. Well, for me, it's a little different than most baseball players or student athletes in general. I'm a fifth year right now, so I only have one class. So I actually have a decent amount of free time, especially with things being online. But the day that I have class, I'll wake up, make some breakfast, have some coffee, and then do some homework or hop on a Zoom call with my class. And then once I'm done with my studies, I usually just head over to the facilities and get some work in, rehab and before practice type stuff to make sure my body's feeling right. And then usually we have 3.5 hour practice. And sometimes we're there earlier or even later than practice, getting in some extra work. And then at night, it's if I have any extra homework to do, I'll do that. If not, it'll be some dinner and hit the hay and then wake up the next morning and attack it all over again.
So last year you had a tremendous season. You batted 364 with 2 homers, 7 doubles and 16 RBIs. Is there anything specific that you can point to that led to your success?
I mean, it was just a long time coming. I struggled a lot in my career here, early freshman, sophomore, and even junior year. I struggled with the mental part of the game most of the time. The game was too fast for me, and I had trouble slowing it down. And the nervousness and anxiousness I got kind of crippled my ability to reach my potential. And I'd say last year was the first year that I actually was able to mentally get to a place where I could be successful and tap into that potential. And I think I did, and the results spoke for themselves.
Great. And last question for you. What are your expectations for the team in the upcoming season?
You know, I mean, success is what I expect, hopefully. You know, last year we struggled a little bit on the mound and in the field a little bit and even in the box. But, you know, this year we're starting to, we have a lot of guys back on the team, a lot of veterans who are now have got some games under their belt and are ready and experienced and know what's about to hit them here. Obviously, it's a unique year with COVID and the type of schedule that we have, only Big Ten, and especially that it's Big Ten, we're going to have to come ready to play. But hopefully we can go out there, compete, and win some games to where you know, the NCAA committee will have to, you know, grant us into those playoffs. So hopeful for a successful year, but we're looking forward to this first weekend next week.
Absolutely. Jack, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem, Jason.
The Minnesota men's baseball team opens their season at U.S. Bank Stadium on Friday, March 5th at 7 p.m. They'll be taking on the Indiana Hoosiers, so make sure to tune in and support your Golden Gophers.
That's all for the Raising Awareness special episode. As always, stay safe, Minnesota. We hope you stay happy, healthy, and connected. Until next time, signing off for Radio K's Real College Podcast, I'm Casey McCabe.